From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, British novelist Martin Amis. His latest book is nonfiction. It's a memoir about writing and being the son of a famous writer. His father, the late Kingsley Amis, wrote satirical novels and was known for a caustic sense of humor and curmudgeonly personality. Martin Amis watched his father lose his sense of humor, his gift for language, and his memory in the final stage of his life. Then we'll hear from one of the grand dames of stage and screen, Lauren Bacall. She's being honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award at this year's Tony Awards party. And film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Moulin Rouge, starring Nicole Kidman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. On today's Archive Edition, an interview with writer Martin Amis. Terry Gross spoke with him last year after the publication of his most recent book, Experience. The paperback edition comes out this month.
Martin Amis is a member of England's most famous writing families. He's best known for his novels Money, London Fields, and The Information. The last two were bestsellers in the States. His father, Kingsley Amis, is best known for his satirical novel Lucky Jim. Kingsley wrote social satires and was known for his caustic wit and curmudgeonly personality. He was knighted in 1990, 5 years before his death. Now Martin Amis has written a memoir about being a writer who is the son of a writer. It's called Experience. Let's start with a reading from the opening chapter.
I am a novelist trained to use experience for other ends. Why should I tell the story of my life? I do it because my father is dead now, and I always knew I would have to commemorate him. He was a writer, and I am a writer. It feels like a duty to describe our case, a literary curiosity which is also just another instance of a father and a son. This will involve me in the indulgence of certain bad habits. Name-dropping is unavoidably one of them, but I've been indulging that habit in a way ever since I first said, Dad. I do it because I feel the same stirrings that everyone else feels. I want to set the record straight, so much of this is already public, and to speak for once without artifice, though not without formality. The trouble with life, the novelist will feel, is its amorphousness, its ridiculous fluidity. Look at it, thinly plotted, largely themeless, sentimental, and ineluctably trite. The dialogue is poor, or at least violently uneven. The twists are either predictable or sensationalist, and it's always the same beginning and the same ending. My organizational principles, therefore, derive from an inner urgency and from the novelist's addiction to seeing parallels and making connections. The method, plus the use of footnotes to preserve the collateral thought, should give a clear view of the geography of a writer's mind. If the effect sometimes seems staccato, tangential, stop-go, etc., then I can only say that that's what it's like on my side of the desk. And I do it because it has been forced on me. I have seen what perhaps no writer should ever see, the place in the unconscious where my novels come from. I couldn't have stumbled on it unassisted, nor did I. I read about it in the newspaper.
Martin Amis, what do you mean by that last line about reading about it in the newspaper?
I had an affair with a married woman in the mid-70s, and she later led me to understand that that the daughter, the two-year-old daughter she had, was in fact mine. And I believed her because I took the photograph she gave me of this little girl to my mother and said, "What do you think, Mom?" And she held it, the photograph, at various distances from her eyes and then said, without looking up, "Definitely." When this became public 20 years later, 18 years later, there was a great deal about it in the newspapers. And the novelist Maureen Duffy wrote a piece saying that if you look at my novels, you can see that from this date on, in the mid-70s, my novels became quietly obsessed with missing children, threatened children, misattributed children, vulnerable children. And when I read it, I felt completely defeated by this piece. I thought, I felt, as it were, busted by this piece. It seemed to me self-evidently true. And no novelist, you know, you don't... What you write about comes from what's at the back of your mind, not at its forefront. You write about what you... the things you don't know you're worrying about. And it was clear to me that that I had been worrying about her, thinking about her. And I was consoled, in fact, because it meant that I had... in the deepest way possible for me, had been with her in spirit far more than I knew. But it was a great shock to have your unconscious laid out before you like that.
Were you grateful to the reviewer for pointing this out to you?
It goes beyond gratitude. It's or distress. It was just something unanswerable. And it was only actually half the picture because I realized also that I'd been worrying about someone else. In 1973, a few weeks after my first novel was published, in fact, my cousin, my mother's sister's child, disappeared. And for 21 years, no one knew what had happened to her. And then it was revealed round about the same time as the identity of my daughter, and when I came to meet my daughter, that she had been murdered and her body had been exhumed from the basement of Frederick West's house in Gloucester, and he being one of the most prolific serial murderers in English history.
It was your missing cousin's body that was found.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. So the combination of these two events, I realized that this had constituted the silent anxiety at the back of my mind when I wrote all those novels.
Martin Amis is my guest. He's written a new memoir called Experience. You say in your memoir that you've said in the past that the present phase of Western literature is higher autobiography, intensely self-inspecting, and that this phase began with confessionalism in American poetry. And you say, we're in this phase where it's no more stories. The author is increasingly committed to the private being. Have you thought of this as a bad thing? I mean, that sounds like a pretty critical way of looking at autobiography or autobiographical fiction, and now you've written a memoir.
I'm suspicious of it, and I don't like the emphasis on the personality. But I'm also susceptible to it, and I feel the same stirrings, as I said, as everyone else. You know, I wrote this book because I came across a natural break in my life. And I always knew I'd have to write about my father in a kind of pro bono spirit because of the, I say modestly, rarity, but in fact uniqueness of our case.
Do you feel you couldn't have written a memoir if your father was still alive, or just that you wouldn't have wanted to?
I wouldn't have wanted to. No, it was always going to be posthumous where he was concerned. It would have been embarrassing. I mean, I couldn't have faced him over the dinner table if I was writing about him while he was alive.
What were your father's roles? And by the way, my guest is Martin Amis, and his father is the late writer Kingsley Amis. What was your father's roles about speaking of or writing about family, speaking of family in public or writing about them?
I don't think he had rules. I don't think he or I had rules. I think you're guided by your instinct and your sensitivity. There's no point in having rules in the publicity age where the rules are broken by others, you know, every day. It would be, you know, frigid and meaningless to just step back from this. So he talked actually often mischievously to the press about me, for instance, and would be quite scathing about the next generation of writers. In his memoirs, he tended to stay away from personal things, but his novels, as I, you know, came to understand, were not autobiographical, but they were about how he was feeling. You know, it's like a damage report or thermometer reading to read someone's novels. You see what the state of their spirit, and that's evident, you know, throughout his corpus.
Your father wrote a memoir. What was in it about you? Did you read the book to learn more about how he felt about you?
Of course, I wrenched it open and looked at the index first to see where I appeared. No, I make little walk-on appearances in his memoirs. But he called that book an allography, i.e. writing about others. And steered clear of personal stuff, to preserve it for the fiction.
Now, you say that your father was always honest about his literary opinions, and one of the things he said about you that's been quoted a lot is that you had a terrible compulsive vividness in your style. He said he can't even finish reading your novels, and, quote, it goes back to one of Martin's heroes, Nabokov. I lay it all at his door, that constant demonstrating of his command of English. What was your reaction when you read that? I mean, on the one hand, your father felt he needed to always be honest about his feelings about books. On the other hand, he could have spared you by saying that he's your father and not your reviewer, and he doesn't have to offer public opinions about your writing.
But he was incapable of fudging an opinion when it came to writing. And I always knew that about him and understood that about him. He thought, basically, and he made it clear to me, too, privately, he said, you know, I think you're the best of a bad lot.
that's high praise.
Yeah, well, it is. And actually, at the highest praise he ever, when we were talking about the rarity of our case, he said, a father and son who are both some good, he said. But I was very moved to hear that, because that was high praise coming from him. But the big difference between him and me is that he was a poet as well as a novelist, and I'm just a novelist. So that all the things that you might reserve for your poetry, in his case, all his thoughts about the spirit and the soul and intense and careful use of words, all that goes into my prose because there's no other channel for it. And that really is the central difference between us.
My guest is Martin Amis. His new memoir is called Experience. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Martin Amis, and he's written a new memoir called Experience, and the book is in part about his father, the late writer Kingsley Amis. Your father had a lot of phobias, including fear of being alone, fear of heights. What were some of the other driving phobias?
Flying, mm-hmm. Trains, lifts. No, he had a rich array of phobias, which I haven't inherited so far.
Have not?
Have not.
Yeah. It's funny that a man with such strong opinions would be so timid when facing a train or you know, just being alone.
I know, and I was thinking back the other day to being in New York. We spent a year in America when I was a child, when I was 9, and we came to New York for the day and went up to the top of the Empire State Building. And I was in awe of this great glittering immensity beneath me, and was very puzzled when my mother said, or my father said, actually, on this occasion, he said that it was only the presence of his children that stopped him from screaming when he was on top of the Empire State Building. It was puzzling and a bit disturbing, but the great thing about parents and children, if all is well in the heart, is that you completely accept them. And you give it a minute's thought, and then you just accept it. You just accept your parents. You accept your children. That's the key to it.
You know, another thing I find so paradoxical about your father's phobias is that he's somebody who appears to have been so critical of other people and yet so needy for them.
Is that a contradiction? I think it's all of a piece, don't you? The fact that you need people around might build up a certain kind of resentment at your own weakness.
But what about at their own weaknesses? I mean, it was other people he was so critical of.
Well, he was critical in his letters and utterances. But, you know, what would you have him do? He was, we prize our writers for their candor. I wouldn't want him any, I wouldn't, you know, he didn't get on with my stuff particularly, but I wouldn't want him to fudge it and pretend that he did. That's what writers are for, to tell the truth as they see it.
How old were you when your parents divorced?
13.
You write a little bit about their divorce, and then you write about your own divorce when you were, what, in your early 40s?
Yes, mid-40s.
And you say that your father wrote that stopping being married to someone is an incredibly violent thing to let happen to you. And you thought about that a lot during your divorce. Were your circumstances similar? Did you both each leave your wives or vice versa? Or?
Well, in fact, I don't write very much at all about my own divorce. And, you know, don't really want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. One of the great subjects of the novel has been marriage. And, you know, what I have to say about the process of being divorced will go to the back of my mind, and I'll worry about it, and in a few years I'll write a novel that will have something to do with it. You select your material when you're writing something like this by thinking about the feelings of others, and I know my ex-wife wouldn't want me to write about it, and that was enough for me. And having felt that, I didn't want to write about it either.
Oh, fair enough. Another thing you do say in your memoir is that only to your father could you confess how terrible you felt, how physically terrible, bemused, subnormalized, stupefied from within during this period of divorce. Only to him could I talk about what I was doing to my children because he had done it to me. Could you talk a little bit about if he was helpful to you, if you were able to talk with him about your feelings about his divorce? And
yeah, that was, I mean, it seems to me that the real violence of divorce is what you are doing to your children. And what that is, simply put, is making them distrustful of love, making them think, well, you'd better not love anyone utterly because things can change, and that's their first lesson in the fragility of love. And my father, I could talk about it with my father, and he was in his 70s, and in fact, you know, only had two or three more years to live. But he really stirred himself and was a great friend to me during that time, and he used to say, talk as much about it as you want or as little about it as you want. And that was his last fatherly duty to me. He rounded the circle. He, you know, he had done the same to me. He had made me distrustful of love and perhaps weakened my capacity to love. But he repaired it, you know, in as much as he could in his last years. It was his last fatherly duty.
Martin Amis is my guest. He's a novelist who's written a new memoir called Experience. You write about your mother, that your mother had a breakdown in 1963, which culminated in an accidental overdose of sleeping pills. She said she had been depressed because she was still in love with your father. You say in 1995, your mother was still contemplating death as an escape from her feelings about your father, but an escape in the opposite direction. What do you mean?
Well, she said, you know, my parents divorced, my mother remarried, and then remarried again, my father remarried. And then when his second wife left him, they set up a kind of ménage where my mother and her third husband, to whom she's still very happily married, moved in and kind of looked after my father and acted as housekeepers for him. My father was always difficult, and later on was impossible, and later on than that was unbelievable. And my mother, you know, blowing the hair off her forehead, would say, you know, I've been dying for a heart attack for years because looking after Kingsley was such hard work. So that's what I meant by escaping in the opposite direction.
That's a really surprising relationship. I'm almost surprised she was willing to do that.
She didn't have a choice, really. It was forced on her because she and her husband had very little money, and my father had money but needed people. So my brother and I kind of, you know, thought this was an obvious, if temporary, solution. We thought it might last 6 months. In fact, it lasted for 12 years and until his death. But, you know, the weird arrangements for weird people. They were always bohemians, and so a bohemian solution was the good one.
So he paid your mother to take care of him and live in the house?
That's right, yeah. With my mother, they had the garden flat below. My mother, stepfather, and my half-brother, little Jaime, and Kingsley had the floor above, and they had a communal floor above that. And somehow it worked.
Well, it made it easier for you to visit both your parents at the same time.
Yeah, no, it was very good for the children. It killed two birds with one stone in all sorts of senses.
Martin Amis speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow.
Coming up, Lauren Bacall remembers her on- and off-screen romance with Humphrey Bogart. Also, Martin Amis talks about the death of his father, the writer Kingsley Amis, and a review of the film Moulin Rouge, starring Nicole Kidman. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with British novelist Martin Amis. His latest book, Experience, due out this month in paperback, is a memoir about being a writer who is the son of a famous writer. His father, Kingsley Amis, is best known for the novel Lucky Jim and for his caustic wit. He was knighted in 1990, 5 years before his death. Terry spoke with Martin Amis last year.
Your father, the writer Kingsley Amis, lost much of his memory before he died. I mean, your father was so much about memory, memory being transformed into fiction. And I'm sure you thought a lot about the meaning of memory, watching your father lose his and lose certain words in the process, too.
Oh, no, it was very much the losing of the words was even more dramatic, and losing humor, and that was the truly devastating thing about his death was that, he has a character say in one of his novels, the rewards of being sane are not many, but knowing what's funny is one of them. And he didn't, towards the end of his, in his last months, he didn't know what was funny. He couldn't find words. It was all closing down. The whole operation, the great engine of comedy that he'd been, was winding down. And it was like something out of a novel, in that it measured up. It had symmetry. That here was this man whose whole life had been devoted to words and their comic possibilities, and he'd become a kind of anti-Kingsley. After he died, and in his last months, as I say, he was reduced to commonplaces and tautologies and the simplest forms of, communication. After he died, I was given a typescript of a book he'd written in his last year or so called The King's English, which is about language and grammar and usage. And it almost gave me a heart attack, because here was my father's voice again. And in fact, it's one of his best books. It's almost a memoir in itself about his love of language and the ways language can make you laugh. And it was published posthumously.
There are so many parallels between your life and your father's life, in part because he was a writer, you're a writer. What did his death, after the loss of so much memory, make you think about facing your own death and possibly, being so transformed in the process, transformed like he was?
Chiefly terror, of course.
Right.
And every time I, stumble over a word or can't remember how to spell something, I think it's starting. Parents, and this is particularly true perhaps of fathers and sons, I mean, they teach you not with catechisms or, little lessons. They teach you by example, and they even, as it turns out, teach you how to die. I think Socrates said the task of philosophy is learning how to die. A big lesson in that is sitting beside your father's hospital bed and watching him do it.
Well, what about the way he did it made you feel that he was teaching you something by example that you wanted to know?
His great friend, the poet Philip Larkin, said, another death-obsessed writer, said that being brave while you die means not scaring others. And, I think that was the great lesson. My father had not much control over what his behavior and the things he said as he was dying, but he did a pretty good job of not scaring his children. There were some very alarming moments and always great suspense when you went to see him during those weeks. But he somehow managed that and died well.
But I think one of the scary things is just watching somebody be so transformed before death, watching them be a different person because they don't have memory anymore. That's scary enough.
Oh, it's very scary. And one of the hospitals he was at, the door to his room had a little glass window set into it, and I, like all his visitors, I'm sure, would peer in through that glass as if at a TV screen to get a kind of a trailer of what lay in store for you, because, you had absolutely no idea what was going to happen in the during your visit. And you would take a deep breath and in you would go. But again, as I said earlier, it's acceptance is what marks the filial and parental relationship. And so even in extremis, you would accept it.
When your father was dying, you say that you told yourself what you'd always told yourself. It's what all writers have always told themselves, consciously or otherwise. The things you feel are universal. Now, did that remind you to yourself that the things you were feeling were universal? Was that an attempt to help you deal with your feelings, knowing that they were universal? Or is that more about writing what you were feeling, feeling that...
No, it was a moral worry, really, because... the death of the father is a complex event. It's not just, you know, feeling sad, and I described the feeling when I was told by my mother that he was going to die, because till quite late on, we thought he would persist in a sort of damaged way for some years, and it felt like I was about to levitate, a sense of impending levitation, rise up off the ground. But in fact, that's expressive and, again, a complex reaction, because you're coming into your own when your father dies. Of course you want him to live forever. And I can boast, and my brother and sister can boast, that we had no regrets. When he died, we wanted him to live forever, but we'd had our time with him. We'd said the words to him. There was nothing left unsaid. There were no bitternesses. So it was all, that was all clear. But to bring in Freud and his vicious embryos again, Freud says that the death of the father makes... It's partly chemical, I suppose, but floods you with endorphins and to get you through the experience. And you feel full of energy and ready for work. And, you know, there are books to be written, there are children to be raised. It's only afterwards that you get, you know, for the rest of your life, you are repairing the damage done, the grief inflicted by the loss of the father. It's you lose a part of yourself, and you never get over that. But the actual business of the father dying is not a simple one of grief. It's you feel this guilty energy and a sort of spring in your step, because you're stepping forward, you're evolving, you're going on to the next stage.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Martin Amis's memoir, Experience, is due out in paperback later this month. Coming up, Lauren Bacall. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, Lauren Bacall will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Tony Awards party. At the age of 19, she knocked everyone out with her screen debut in the 1944 film To Have and Have Not. 1 year later, she married her leading man, Humphrey Bogart. They'd been married over 11 years when Bogart died of cancer. Their screen lives together included the films The Big Sleep, Dark Passage, and Key Largo. Bacall also starred in Young Man with a Horn, How to Marry a Millionaire, Designing Woman, Murder on the Orient Express, The Shootist, and Misery. Terry spoke with Lauren Bacall in 1994 about her on- and off-screen relationship with Humphrey Bogart.
I think a lot of people have been a little disappointed by life and by love because they compare it to what they've seen in the movies and it never quite measures up to the movie version. Before you ever really experienced love, you were acting out the movie version of romance. And then you started having the romance with the person who you were acting it out with on screen.
And I guess I'm really wondering if there was anything disappointing about the real-life version of it, even though it was the same two people who were doing it on screen.
No, you mean if there was any disappointment in my marriage, in my life with
no,
Bogey,
in the early romance of
the
it.
The early romance was the most romantic experience I have ever had in my life. Far surpassing anything that I might have dreamed of or imagined. It was quite amazing. I mean, when you are young and when it's your first love and you are just carried away by it and when that's all you can think about. And you see, Bogey was the kind of man who believed in taking care of a marriage and taking care of a relationship. He believed you had to work at it and keep it fresh and fun and interesting, and he did.
He was already a movie star to you, right?
Oh, yes,
when you worked
absolutely.
Together. So you had a sense of him as an icon as well as
no,
a man.
No, not as an icon. He was not my favorite movie star.
Mm-hmm. Did you tell him that?
Yes, he knew it. No, Leslie Howard was my favorite. Uh-huh. He knew that. But he had worked with Leslie Howard in Petrified Forest, which is funny, you know. No, he wasn't an icon when I met him. I mean, he would, because it was after Casablanca, and he was a big star, but certainly not what he is today, which is this legend, this incredible icon now. I mean, he is bigger than ever.
I'm sure you've been asked this a zillion times, but do you think that what you and Bogart were feeling off screen, you can see on screen? I mean, that the real relationship registers in the movie?
Well, I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. Certainly the chemistry registers, whether it is a consummated relationship or not. I think if there is chemistry between two people, you feel it. I think that Bogey and myself in To Have and Have Not, I think having fallen in love with one another, finally, I think, first of all, it was great for me because it gave him, he wanted me to be good in it, so he made it much easier for me to play the scenes. And of course, my feeling, you know, the feeling was so strong that, you know, originally in To Have and Have Not, his character was supposed to have a little flirtation with the other woman. And once Hawks saw the rushes of the scenes that Bogey and I had played, Bogey said to him, nobody is ever going to accept or believe that he would go off with anybody else for a second. And it was true.
When you and Bogart decided to get married, you write that he said to you that he wanted to marry you, but only if you were willing to give up going on location for a film because he didn't want you both going off in different directions.
Right.
How do you feel about that in retrospect?
Well, I recognize the fact completely that separation does not breed a happy marriage. I think you must be together. I mean, the reason you get married is to be together, not to be separated. And I think particularly in my profession, but in any profession, I think if you each go off in opposite directions, sooner or later, one of you is going to go off and not come back. And I think that's natural. I agreed to his terms.
But you wanted so much to be an actress.
Right.
And this cut down on the roles that you could take.
Yes, oh, absolutely. And I never even got the offers because I was thought of as Bogey's wife and then I would just go with him on location, which I did. And we were never separated. We were separated once only for a very short time.
Well, you know, I was thinking how in a way frustrating it must have been when he was making African Queen with Katharine Hepburn. You were there in Africa with them, kind of suffering through through all of the problems they had to suffer through. But I mean, you were there as the wife. And
I was there as the wife. I was
not
in charge
as the star.
Of lunch. No, right.
So
no,
how
but
did
you
that
know,
feel?
I had a lot of frustrations mm-hmm. about my career.
Mm-hmm.
Times where I felt I should have been considered for a part that I wasn't considered for. Bogey had decided early on and told me from the very beginning that he would never interfere with my career. That whatever I did professionally, I would do only with myself and my agent. If I wanted his advice, I could ask him, but that he would never step in, and he never did. And sometimes I thought, well, he ought to step in. I mean, once in a while, I should be in a movie with him, that one of the parts. But whatever his decision was, he was correct because he'd had enough experience to know what worked and what didn't work. And I was very frustrated at times, but I still believe, and I even believed then, that even throughout my frustration, that the choice I made was the right one. Obviously, in view of what happened, it most certainly was the right one. And I'm really happy that I made that choice.
Because your life together
was
short.
Well, because he had a life. He had a life that he never thought he would have. And it was very short. But imagine if I'd gone off somewhere. Well, I mean, he wouldn't have stood for it anyway, so.
I want to ask you about working with some of the many people you've worked with
yes,
over the
absolutely.
Years and see if you could share some of your impressions of them. You work with Marilyn Monroe on mm-hmm. How to Marry a Millionaire. How was the experience of working with her?
It was fine. I mean, we got along very well. My only complaint about her was that she was late all the time. But she was late out of fear as much as anything else. But it was hard to sit around and wait, you know. But she was usually an hour or two late every morning.
You strike me as such different types, probably off the screen, certainly on the screen.
Oh, yes, we are. I mean, I wish I had been as photogenic as she was. But she was a very kind of sweet, kind of far away, very self-involved, but not... I mean, she had no meanness. She was not bitchy. She was not strident in any way. She was just always seemed a little lost to me, wistful kind of, but just kind of not quite there. Do you know what I mean? And you'd be playing a scene with her, and she would go over and over the scene, and you'd have to be on your toes because she'd do many, many takes. And she always had the coach on the set, which was a big annoyance, you know, that's constantly... Instead of looking at you, she'd be looking at the coach. That kind of thing was difficult. But personally, she really was sweet. I mean, we did get along well.
John Wayne, you worked with him in two movies, Storm Warning in the 50s.
No, Blood Alley. Yeah.
Oh, Blood Alley, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's what I mean. Blood Alley in the 50s, and then The Shootist in, was it 75, 76?
77,
okay. And that The Shootist was his last movie, and he had cancer in real life and also in the movie,
that
the character
was,
you know, an aged gunfighter who was dying of cancer. I'm wondering what it was like then, knowing that he was really sick, that would probably be his last movie, not wanting to kind of over-dramatize the significance of that, but here he is playing out the drama on screen that's happening off screen, and you know what's happening, but you don't want to get too...
Well, you couldn't with him.
Mm-hmm.
I learned through Bogey's illness... that the person who is ill is the one who dictates your behavior.
Right, right. You take your cues from them.
Right. And Bogey never discussed it and never talked about it once after his surgery. And so I never did.
Mm-hmm.
And
you never
Duke
talked
was
about
the
it together?
No. No. And... You know, we say some days, you know, I don't feel so good today, or I have to do this, you know, I have to go have this radiation or what, you know, stuff like that. But, I mean, he never talked to me about if something happens or what might, you know, never. Now, Duke was the same. Duke never talked about it. I mean, mind you, I wasn't married to him, but he still, we knew each other fairly well and never talked about it, and he handled himself impeccably. Well, you have to go along with that. You know, he was, He was very strange contradiction of a man to me because of course, politically we didn't agree about anything.
Mm-hmm.
We were really on opposite sides and vehemently so we never discussed it, obviously. But we worked very well together. And he was sweet with me and he was really attractive, you know. He had a quality that surprised me, that he did have a kind of a real appeal. I mean, there was a reason he was such a big star. He was a real man, and he had real appeal.
Lauren Bacall from a 1994 interview with Terry Gross. This Sunday, Bacall will receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Tony Awards party. Coming up, a review of the new film Moulin Rouge. This is Fresh Air. Baz Luhrmann's new musical Moulin Rouge made a splashy premiere at this year's Cannes Film Festival. A replica of the 1890s music hall where Nicole Kidman plays the star singer was set up on a pier. Can-can dancers flanked Kidman as she entered the post-film party. The film also features Ewan McGregor as her love interest and Jim Broadbent as the cabaret's producer. Film critic Henry Sheehan has a review.
Moulin Rouge begins with an exquisite shot of a place that no longer exists, turn-of-the-century Paris. Director Baz Luhrmann moves his camera with indulgent languor over a wonderfully evocative cityscape of tiled rooftops that has as much to do with our collective romantic imaginations as it does with any Paris that ever existed. That's good, though. As the great filmmaker Ernst Lubitsch once said, he loved Paris, France, but he preferred Paris paramount. Luhrmann is making a similar statement with his camera. If only Moulin Rouge could have stuck to this simple but profound dreamy mood. But in a harbinger of difficulties to come, our vision also passes by a rooftop singer. It's Toulouse-Lautrec, or at least the artist as embodied by an annoyingly high-pitched John Leguizamo. He's lounging on a roof singing Nature Boy, the old Nat King Cole hit that is a standby of drunken midnight sing-alongs in cheap piano bars. In other words, it's completely, utterly camp, the nemesis of straightforward romance. This is the tension that finally undermines Moulin Rouge, an ambitious musical that tries nothing less than to impose a mythic love story over a backdrop of pop culture ferment. The music itself is deliberately anachronistic, drawn largely, but not only, from the top 40 lists of the 1970s and 80s. Elton John's Your Song, warbled by a musically and dramatically thin Ewan McGregor, is its anthem. Lady Marmalade, its analog to Offenbach's Can-Can theme. And Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend is its show-stopping introduction of its star, Nicole Kidman. For all the finery of a movie that depends on fabulous sets and computer effects for its look, Moulin Rouge finally succumbs to the laws of stardom. How you react to the movie depends a great deal on how you react to Kidman, who plays the singer and dancer Satine, the main attraction at the notorious Montmartre cabaret, the Moulin Rouge, and the love object of Christian, a young English writer played by McEwan. Kidman has her hair dyed a Rita Hayworth red, and when we see her doing the elaborate diamonds number, her sheath-like dress manages to evoke both Hayworth and Monroe. When Luhrmann comes in for a close-up on her ravishing face, the actress's red eyebrows and blue eyes are as art-directed as anything else in view. But even here, there's a complication in the contrast between Kidman's slim athletic body and her model's fleshy ones. It was an easy difference to overlook, but impossible to ignore. And only Kidman and the terrific English actor Jim Broadbent are able to tame Luhrmann's usually unsuccessful struggle to match the sincere and the camp. The movie's plot is ostentatiously, deliberately derivative. Naive writer Christian falls for worldly performer Satine, who loves him back. But impresario Ziedler, Broadbent's character, persuades Satine to sleep with a rich duke, who in return will finance the next Moulin Rouge show. Here, Ziedler talks Satine into doing the right, wrong thing.
Send Christian away. Only you can save him.
He'll fight for me.
Yes, unless he believes you don't love him.
What?
Make him believe you don't love him.
No.
Use your talent to save him. Hurt him. Hurt him to save him. There is no other way. The show must go on, Satine. We're creatures of the underworld. We can't afford to love.
This is a rare moment when the movie works orally as well as it does visually. Yet, if you were to pass on Moulin Rouge, you'd be depriving yourself of Luhrmann's unabashed visual imagination. Over the streets of Montmartre, he plasters a smiling man in the moon who, when he breaks into song, does it in the voice of Placido Domingo. This and 1,000 other small and large touches make Moulin Rouge an eye-popping spectacle, if finally a cold and timid one.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold as girls grow old, and we all lose our charms in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
Fresh Air is produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Monique Nazareth, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Research assistants from Jessica Chu. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Seuss Bolin directed the show. Terry Gross returns on Monday. I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Cats and Men, a story collection by Nina de Gramont. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of an accidental revolutionary. When Linus Torvalds developed Linux, a new computer operating system, he put the source code out on the internet, inviting all to assist him in its creation. He's just written a new memoir about the process. Join us for the next Fresh Air.